Good evening, everyone. Thank you so much for coming out. It's always wonderful for a debut author to attract fans. You know, there's always this terrifying feeling that maybe not for you, but for me anyway, a terrifying feeling that we will host this event and nobody will actually come to meet a new author. So I thank you so much for doing that. And also, you will now have bragging rights, because if you don't show up at their first event, you will never be able to say, I was there when, which at this bookstore has happened a lot more often than you might think. Anyway, thank you, virtual fans, for joining us. And our author tonight is indeed debut author Nina Simon. And if you hold up your book, there's a sticker on it now, right?
Yeah.
That actually says Reese's Book Club Pick. And so it's been announced as Tuesday, right?
Mm-hmm.
That it is the September pick for Reese's Book Club. Now, I don't know. What do you think that actually means? I've often wondered. Because around here, you know, we don't actually pay that much attention to it. It's all about what we like as a staff. But, you know, out in the real world, maybe Reese has a lot more influence than Patrick and I.
All I know is that when my editor called to tell me that this had happened, she told me that I needed to sit down, that it was going to change my life, and that it was like the Super Bowl of publishing. I'm not a football fan, but I kind of have a sense that, you know, that means something good. We did on Monday night, I have a 10-year-old, and so we watched Legally Blonde, which she had never seen, because I felt that she needed some context for who was this blonde lady who was going to be talking about the book. But it has been incredible just in the last couple of days, just seeing online just so much energy and enthusiasm and excitement about the book and curiosity about the book. And I just feel very blessed and lucky that she decided to put her sticker on this book for September.
It is wonderful. I'm so glad you said Legally Blonde. Merle, you probably shopped here long enough to know that the woman who wrote Legally Blonde is actually the daughter of one of the art dealers who was two doors down from us in the original Poison Pen over on Main Street across from Mallet's. Do you remember what her name was? Suzanne Brown. And it was her daughter who wrote Legally Blonde, which was an okay book, but turned into a whole
terrific
movie franchise thing, right?
Yeah.
So I'd forgotten about, there's another, you know, local literary star, so to speak.
There you go.
Right. No movie deals so far. We should get that out of the way early.
The book was optioned, but it all happened right before the writer's strike, so we'll see what happens. Yeah. And not by Hello Sunshine, by somebody else. So it's nobody you would know. I don't know. I signed something. I don't think I can say who they are, but it would not be immaterial. You know, that is the longest of long shots. But I will say that the main character of this book, you know, Mother-Daughter Murder Night is about three generations of women, a grandma, a single mom, and a teenage girl who work together to solve this murder mystery. And the grandmother, Lana, when I was working with my agent, in the early draft of this book, Lana was a little older, and my agent said, you know, we should really age her down. And so my mom, who I'd written it for, was 72 at the time. I had already aged Lana down to 62, and my agent said, you know, can we get her in the 55 to 58 range? And so I looked up all these famous celebrities online, and Sandra Bullock was 57, and I decided I am not going to age Lana down enough that Sandra Bullock could not someday play her in an adaptation. So that's my personal dream, but you know, we'll see what happens. Lana has a lot of moments of physical humor in this book, and I feel like Sandra Bullock is a great physical comedian. And Lana's also very good at manipulating men to get what she wants, and I think that's also a Sandra Bullock asset as well.
Right. So this book actually has a wonderful backstory, which is both hopeful and poignant. Why don't you tell us? It's a long story, but I think everybody should hear it.
Yeah. So I never expected to write this book or a novel at all. My past work was in engineering and then in exhibit design for museums. I was a museum director. And I wrote some nonfiction on the side about museum work, but fiction was only in my life as a very avid reader. And then 3 years ago, I got a phone call that just terrified me. It was actually my daughter's birthday, and it was my mom's boyfriend on the phone, and he told me that my mom had just been diagnosed with tumors in her brain, and she needed an emergency brain surgery. And I rushed down to Los Angeles to be with her. Over the next few days, we discovered it wasn't only in her brain, but also in her lungs and in her bones. And very quickly, I went into those calculations that I'm sure some folks in here have been through of, how can I change my life to be with my mom, because this is all that matters to me right now. And I quit my job. My husband and my daughter were very understanding. I spent a lot of time down in Los Angeles for a long time. And then, and I just remember during that time, you know, my friends saying to me, you know, you'll never regret the time you spend with your mom during this time. And I think they're absolutely right. But there was also something that they didn't say, which is that that time that you spend together is not always joyful. It's not always fun. It's certainly not easy. And I think that for my mom and I, all we were talking about was cancer. You know, and I'm a big fan of poetry. And Jane Kenyon, after she died, her husband, who was also a poet, Donald Hall, he talked about this idea that in any loving relationship, there's always a third thing. She said, you know, we don't spend all our time in our relationship gazing into that person's eyes. We often are spending our time on a third thing. You know, maybe it's a beloved art form or a pet or our children or a sports team, and that we're communicating often about that third thing. And what I found was when my mom got sick, this third thing came into our life that we did not choose and that was not fun to talk about. And I saw my mom as she lost her energy, you know, as she lost her hair. But it was really only when she lost her hope that I started to get very concerned. And my mom and I have always loved murder mysteries. She introduced me to them as a little kid, and maybe not that little. I don't want her to sound like, you know. So we started rereading some old favorites together, Janet Ivanovich and Faye Kellerman. And then, you know, one day I just turned to her and I said, you know, what if I tried writing a murder mystery with someone like you as the lead detective? And that's really where Mother-Daughter Murder Night was born. She and I would brainstorm about these women who, a little bit like us, you know, a tough, pushy Jewish businesswoman in L.A. who gets sick and is forced to move in with her caring nurse daughter and her teenage adventurous granddaughter in the Monterey Bay, which is where I live. I should say, in real life, first of all, my mom is doing quite well now. I feel like I need to say that, and it's amazing. I know, I'm sorry. I know, you're like, what is, you know, this is, yeah. But my mom has never left Los Angeles, and yeah, she's not in remission, but she's really doing well. She was with me at the launch in Santa Cruz on Tuesday. We'll be together in LA next week for an event. I could never get her to leave Los Angeles, but it turns out when you write fiction, you can actually make the characters do whatever you want them to do. So so in the book, of course, when Lana Rubicon gets sick, she's forced to move up to my area to live and renegotiate her relationship with her daughter and granddaughter. And the women in this book, you know, and the development of this book was completely rooted in my mom and our conversations. I mean, we would just sit for hours in these hospital waiting rooms talking about, oh, should the murderer be like this? And what if the victim was like that? And do you think it's too weird if there's a clue like this? And the first attempts I did at writing this book, I would just be sitting on her bed while she was asleep with my laptop. And I would write a scene. And then when she woke up, you know, I'd go make her breakfast and I'd pass her the laptop and she'd read what I'd written, and then we'd talk about it. She would give me lots of notes about things I had to change, and we went along like that for a long time. And it just became for us a new third thing, one that we chose instead of being foisted upon us. You know, cancer did not disappear from our conversations or our time together, but it was no longer the center of every conversation. And as my mom started to get a little better, I found I was getting so into this new creative work and this new relationship with work. And so I kept writing. And of course, my mom continued to be my first reader and my research buddy. You know, I always remember she called me from chemo one day. She's like, Nina, I'm reading this book about Elkhorn Slough, which is where the book is set. She's like, and there's this poisonous frog who lives in the slough, and maybe there could be a murder that involves this poison. And she's getting very into it. And then suddenly her voice drops and she says, oh, sorry, the nurses just came by and they were giving me alarmed looks. And so we just found a lot of joy as I was writing, as we were discussing this book. And even, you know, we never imagined that it was going to end up, you know, being published by William Morrow, having a sticker, being here with you tonight. What we imagined and what mattered to us was really about the intimate connection we were building with each other through this project that gave us a place to escape and to dream and to just find joy together during a really hard time.
It's a wonderful story. And I was sorry your mom didn't pop into our Zoom event. For any of you watched it, her mom was just off stage. And I would love to.
When I sent her pictures of the hotel today, she was like, I should have come. I'm like, I know you should have come. But
she has limits. Right. Sorry, it's the air conditioning that gets to me here. I mean, this is like a little wind tunnel here. And I apologize for the clunky sound up there. We're going to have all the ductwork redone because it sounds as though the whole store is going to fall on your head every time the air conditioning turns off. Right. And it might fall through right here on the floor. That'd be really exciting. Right. So let's talk about the slough, because Elkhorn Slough is a very, very special place. If any of you have ever driven either up from Los Angeles to Monterey or down from San Francisco or Santa Cruz, Elkhorn Slough is slightly north of Monterey, and there is you describe it, because it's really the slough itself and then the industrial towers right beside it that make it a very interesting place.
Yeah, absolutely. So I'll share a little bit about it, and I'll read a little bit about it from the book. So Elkhorn Slough is the second biggest marine preserve, estuary on the West Coast after the San Francisco Bay. So if you're ever visiting Carmel or Big Sur or Santa Cruz, where I live, it's worth a visit to Moss Landing and Elkhorn Slough. It's an incredible estuary filled with, wildlife. You will always see otters there. If you ever are wondering, where can I see otters on demand? You can go to Elkhorn Slough. They are there every day. They do not take a day off. But there are otters, there are jellyfish, there are pelicans, there are sea lions. And yet there also is this power plant right there. There also is this working marina there. There also is PCH. The highway runs right through it. And so you have this really interesting confluence of a very wild place with a very industrial place. And I don't know about you, but I always find that it's in these places that are sort of on the border of different things, of the human and the natural world, of urban and rural, where there's a lot of creative friction and often a lot of conflict. And to me, that felt like it gave it both a beauty and a spookiness that made it a great setting for a crime. So I'll just read a little bit from when Lana and her daughter Beth are driving up from Los Angeles when they have to leave to move Lana into Beth's home. After 2 hours crawling through city traffic, they left the sprawl of Los Angeles. They wound up a mountain pass lined with citrus trees, Beth's Camry chugging uphill as the stars came out. Lana shut her eyes at the first vineyards, and Beth drove on in silence, watching the rolling hills give way to the inky Monterey Bay. Even in the dark, the ocean made itself known, waves roaring onto rocks, spraying salt and mist over the bridge that separated sea from strawberry fields. Beth's house was perched between ocean and farmland on a tiny strip of gravel and sand above Elkhorn Slough. Beth loved the way the wetland shifted with the tides, rising and falling like a lover's breath below her house. When she'd first moved in 15 years ago, she'd seen Elkhorn as a temporary refuge. But she'd grown to relish its foggy mornings and wild treasures, soft where Los Angeles was hard, scruffy where the city was slick. As Beth walked her mother to the door, she resisted the urge to point out the driftwood planters she'd carved and filled with succulents, the wreath of bracken fern she'd braided herself. She steered Lana to Jack, that's her daughter's bedroom, bracing for her mother to pronounce her verdict on the secondhand furniture, the nicked floorboards, the peaty smell of the slough wafting up from outside. That night, Lana didn't say anything about home decor or river mud. Lana didn't say anything at all. Her face was locked in grim determination, mouth shut tight. Beth opened the door to Jack's bedroom, waved Lana onto the bed, and helped her take off her shoes. It scared Beth to see her mother so compliant. It was easier, too.
Very nice. Right. And it is that combination of very rural, very natural, so forth, and as you say, the industrial stuff. And unsurprisingly, this being California or Arizona, you can always sense evil developers hovering right along, right?
Yeah.
We're kind of used to those guys. Right. Only in your case, you're not asking that crucial question, where's the water coming from, which is the one we should be asking every single time.
Yeah.
So why don't we start with Beth, because it'd be easier sort of to discuss her and then go down to Jack and then finally go up to Lana.
Sure.
So tell us about Beth. Beth has a somewhat complicated backstory, but she's made a life for herself despite some perhaps difficult early choices.
Yeah, I think all three of these women, you know, one of the things I was really trying to explore with this book is what does it mean to be a strong woman? And how do we define that? And could it be defined in multiple ways? Or is there really only one way to look at it? And Lana certainly is somebody who defines being strong in a way that I think is very typically male. You know, she's very independent. She's built a big business. She is successful. She has power. And her daughter, Beth, is very different from her. Her daughter, Beth, wants to be a caregiver, becomes a nurse, is a teen mom who makes her own life for herself, and really defines herself and her strength through her care for others, for her care for her daughter, but also for her care for the patients who she works with. She works at a geriatric, senior assisted living home in the Monterey Bay in the Carmel area. And I think that one of the things that for me was so interesting in writing Beth was that I'm somebody who, and my mom is the same way, we identify more as Lana's. You know, when I, when my mom got sick, she and I were both CEOs of different organizations, you know, and that ended abruptly for both of us. And I think that I really had defined strength in this very specific way. And writing Beth, who is this mother and who is so giving, was an opportunity for me personally to learn not just to admire a person like that, not just to see it as noble, but to learn to love and embrace the caregiver inside of me, which is not something I feel like had been a big part of my life beforehand. I have a great kid, but I also have a husband who was always the lead, you know, when she was a little baby and that kind of thing. And so I think that going through the journey from me and my mom led me to really be able to write Beth as somebody who is trying to define herself away from her mother, away from the city, but also cares so much about her relationships and I think is really yearning to have a closer relationship with her mom than she does in the start, at least.
So Beth split away from Lana and moved to the SLU because Beth was a pregnant teenage mother.
That's right.
Right? And not only that, it was multiracial, if I remember right.
That's right.
Jack is, in fact, multiracial. So, you know, Beth, however that happens to her, has to make some interesting choices. So she's living in a little house that she's built herself. She's managed to get herself. Does she actually have a degree in nursing?
Yes, she does. Yeah,
I think she went
to nursing school, but I think that she would have liked to have gone on the path to being a doctor someday, but having Jack derailed her from that.
Right.
But certainly she's somebody who's made her own way, but has chosen this natural place, this, you know, home that to her mom looks like a shack falling into a mud pit, but to her is this very beautiful homemade space that is filled with a lot of love and a lot of warmth.
Right. So she's really made a very satisfactory life. Jack has grown up in this environment. And Lana is going to just be an incredible disruption.
That's correct.
So,
yeah.
Well,
I wonder if I could read a little bit from when Lana,
sure.
So this is when, Lana, before Lana goes to Monterey, when she just discovers and calls Beth to talk about this, you know, crisis that has led her into the hospital. Beth, listen to me. This is Lana speaking. They're telling me I've got tumors, lots of them, in my brain, that I need surgery right away. But you should see the shoes this doctor is wearing. I mean, how can he expect anyone to take him seriously? Beth's face froze in a half smile. Wait, slow down. Where are you? Are you okay? Besides being held hostage by a radiologist who can't be bothered to brush his own hair, I'm fine. I'm at City of Angels Hospital. They say I can't check myself out, that someone has to take care of me. I need to get to a better facility, one with real doctors in decent suits. So the non-question hung in the air. If Lana had ever asked for Beth's help before, she couldn't remember it. Demanded her attention? Sure. Assumed her acquiescence? Constantly. But needed her help? Valued her expertise. If Beth weren't so worried, she'd mark the day on the calendar with a gold star. So I think even in that little bit, you can get the sense of, Lana is this sort of wrecking ball of her own idea about what is right and, you know, what passes muster. And when she crashes into the little natural world that Beth has created for herself and Jack, it certainly is a big disruption. And then when her mother decides that she's going to investigate a murder from bed in this ramshackle cottage that Beth has, it's even more of a disruption.
So Lana is not just a health crisis. Lana has built basically a real estate empire in Los Angeles, and it's all gone bad. So not only is her health gone, but so has her her business, and so she's facing, you know, financial ruin as well as physical ruin. But what's interesting about Lana is that even though this is happening to her, she's not for one second giving into it. So she's forced to go to the SLU and stay with Beth and Jack, but she never went in, you know, she's never going to like give in and just stay there or stay in bed. She's an absolutely outrageous character. Some of her dialogue is amazing. So did you make that up, or, you know, where did you get some of the astonishing dialogue that comes out of Lana? It's pretty scary if it was just something you actually knew as opposed to made up.
Yeah, no, I mean, most of it's made up. Certainly I was inspired by the tough single Jewish mothers who I grew up around, not just my mom, but a lot of her friends who were chosen aunties to me. But also, I think I was writing Lana as a kind of super extreme version of my own mom, and sort of this superhero element of, while my mom was in bed, Lana was getting out of bed and kicking butt. You know, while my mom was, you know, getting pushed around by doctors, Lana was pushing the doctors around. And so I think that there was this sort of wish fulfillment of writing a character who both craves power, but also exudes power in a way that means that really nothing is standing in her way, even though she's facing some quite serious obstacles to asserting herself.
Well, she has stage 4 cancer. Right. I mean, you know, it really is pretty. So Jack is out one day, and there's a body floating in the SLU. It's always handy, isn't it, when there's a bottle of water so that you can float a body to it. I just started William Kent Kruger's book because I'm going to talk to him Saturday. And the first thing we know is that there's a body in the water, and the catfish have largely eaten the body. Mm. But they can still kind of recognize him. Mm. So, right. You have to hope that he was dead when he went into the water. That's what you'd like to think. But it's very handy in writing crime, you know, mystery, to have a convenient body of water where somebody can show up. So here's poor Jack, who finds the body, and that automatically makes her a suspect, because that's just how it works, you know, that the person who finds the body is very often assumed to be the suspect, if it indeed it is. Because not everybody in the water is actually a murder victim.
Right.
You know, maybe it's a person who just drowned.
Right.
Which seems to happen almost every day here in Phoenix. Have you noticed?
Really?
People are constantly dying. And, you know, I have to wonder, are they drinking and swimming, or are they falling off boats? Or
Yeah. Huh.
There was one in the paper today, I know, and, you know, some Lake Pleasant or something. And anyway, so we don't know for sure, do we? Or do we? Does the body visibly?
We don't know for sure, no. So Jack is, she's 15, and she exudes strength in a different way. She's a real outdoor adventurer and explorer. And so she has this part-time job leading kayak tours. And so when she comes upon this dead body, it is during a tour. There's actually a father and son who have come upon it, and she goes to help them. And the body, there's no boat around, but the man is wearing a life jacket from that kayak tour operation. So it starts out with this question about, you know, was it somebody from her tour or something like that? And I wonder if this will be the last thing I wanted to read, but just when Jack finds him, this is right after that happened, and I think it just gives a sense of a different kind of strength that this third point of view character in the book has. So this is right after she's found the body. After a stunned moment in her boat with her head between her knees, Jack snapped into efficiency mode. She had responsibilities. She radioed the Coast Guard, then wrangled the father and son to rejoin the group. She did a count. Everyone on her tour was there, and they were going back to dry land now. The dead guy was on the bank, and he wasn't going anywhere. The father looked nauseous, the son a spinning top of adrenaline and fear. But Jack kept her voice calm and firm, and they followed her directions. Jack led the group back to the kayak shack in a ragged line, her paddle churning through the water like a quiet, determined dishwasher. The tour group passed under the highway and across the chopped up ocean. News spread from boat to boat in whispers and heads whipping around to look back as if to accuse the slew of ruining their day. The boats approached the shore. Travis was on the boat launch ramp, waving his arms like a girl at a drag race, too smiley by a mile, and Jack realized she hadn't called or told anyone at the kayak shack what had happened. As far as everyone at the marina was concerned, this was just another group of tourists to unload. She shot a glare at Travis, who was trying to tease a smile from an older woman along with her paddle. He didn't get it. Jack hauled her kayak up and stomped over at him. "Travis, you're not going to believe this." "What's up?" "We found a body, a dead person, in the slough. Can you get Paul on the phone and tell him to come down here? I'll close the group out." "Whoa, are you..." "Just go. Now. Please." Jack's grandma had always told her it was always good to give men simple instructions in complicated situations.
So here we have these three women, all very different, and we have a dead body, and Jack is sort of in jeopardy. And so obviously entered the police, or in this case, it's the sheriff, isn't
That's
it?
That's right, yep.
Because, as you know, police are city and town, and county is sheriff. So this is out in the county. So comes the sheriff and kind of goes on from there.
That's
but
right.
The motive for Beth, and really for Lana, is to protect Jack.
Right. Yeah, and I think that I needed Jack because Lana and Beth have had a hard relationship. They had a rift in their relationship when Beth left as a teenager. And you know how sometimes when you've had something like that, it can be very hard to come back together. But they both really care about Jack. They both want to protect Jack. They have very different opinions about how to do that. Beth would like a lawyer. Lana would like to solve the case herself because she thinks the sheriffs are idiots. And Lana and Jack kind of become a tag team investigating duo. And Beth, you know, really feels at first very nervous about this, but eventually they become a trio, really working together and each using their own strengths so that they can find the real murderer, clear Jack's name, and keep everybody in the slough safe.
So the assumption, of course, is that Jack is not actually the person
it's not that kind of book.
Responsible for the death. It's not one of these psychological things where, you know, in the end you find out it was Jack all along. So thank you for that.
Yeah, I have a hard time reading unreliable narrators. I respect it, but I don't know. I guess I come to murder mysteries as a reader for comfort, and I love traditional mysteries where it's like, you know, an injustice is done, there's a rift in the social fabric, and then these investigators piece it together and the rift is healed. And I think that that's why my mom and I turned to murder mysteries when she was sick for comfort, and that's certainly why, you know, I wanted to write that into this book.
Sure, and they make wonderful escape reading. And most of the time, they come out the way you want them to, although sometimes the solutions are, you know, painful. Or what I really hate is when there's no solution at all. Read your way through a murder mystery and then, you know, there's really no, or an ambiguous resolution, which I consider to be bad editing. But
I definitely wanted there to be a satisfying ending and for, you know, to really work with readers so that I was once told, you know, a murder mystery is the only kind of book where the author and the reader are in a competition to get to the end, and the reader's trying to solve it before the end, and the author is trying to keep you guessing until the end, and that you're playing this game and you're trying to play fair, of course, with how you're sharing the clues. I mean, I think the other thing about this book, and one of the things I loved about working with my editor at William Morrow, Liz Stein, is that it's a murder mystery, but it's also a family drama. And I think that when I first wrote it, I wrote it that way because I had so much love for these women. But, you know, a lot of people in publishing, they want to put you in a lane. And so I talked to some people who said, well, this is nice, but we should really go all in on the mystery and let's cut some of this family stuff. And then I talked to other editors who said, well, this is nice, but we should really downplay the mystery and let's just make this a family drama. And Liz at William Morrow said, you know, yes, I see how, let's make it both, and let's make it as strong as we can with both. And I feel like I learned so much from her to be able to try, at least, to really weave and balance both those elements into this story.
And apparently you at least did well enough for Reese.
Well, and hopefully, and for the poison pen, you
That's
know.
That's right.
You caught it before she did, so.
I did. There are, I mean, the first thing I thought when I read the book and read about the slough was I was thinking about Crawdads, you know, where the Crawdads sing. Now, I had D.D. Owens here in 2018, and I had I had absolutely no idea. Do you remember? We have a photo of her sitting in the back room. Saying there were like two people that came. And no, I'm serious. And, you know, she was sitting back there signing books. And, you know, if I were really a genius bookseller, I'd have had, what, like 5,000 books in the back room for her to sign. But it was a book that I'm still slightly puzzled by why it took off the way it did. I mean, I know it's not, I mean, I liked it a lot, obviously, but I didn't expect it to turn into the kind of enormous bestseller across all channels that it turned into. Have many of you read? All right. So what did you like about it? This is a question we were asking. What was it about Crawdads that appealed to you the most? I'll start with you.
I like the fact that I would have never believed she did it. She was the killer because she was so soft.
Okay. All right. How about you? I saw you wave. What did you think? Raising herself, right? Yeah, I mean, it's sort of a hero's journey, you know, in that respect. Anybody over here? What would you say?
The strength of the character, like in seeing her kind of growing from the experience she had with her dad and having to deal with that and how she transitioned into this stronger woman who's going to be able to take her.
Did you expect it to be a mystery? When you started reading it?
I wasn't sure.
Yeah. Anybody else?
I just like the way it was something about reading her words that made me feel calm in the story. It wasn't so much where the story was going, and sometimes not even what it was about, it was just how she wrote it. It was just the feeling that it gave.
Anybody else want to chime in? Well, I'm captured by landscape. I absolutely love landscape. And that was the thing that originally hooked me on Crawdads, was I thought the place, you know, the whole area was amazing. And Delia wrote about it with real knowledge and authority. And then, as you say, it's the story of this young girl, you know, trying to survive and thrive and all the rest of it. I wasn't sure it was a mystery when I first started reading it, but then it turns out to be. Anyway, if I were a genius, as I said, I would have had, you know, thousands of copies here to sign. And so when I started reading about the slough, I had that same reaction that I had to the landscape in Crawdads, was, you know, I just loved the slough. And actually, I've been there. Yeah. You know, I've driven past it many times. But I've never, when I say I've been there, I've been by it, but I don't think I've ever been in it.
Yeah, it's worth going in. You know, I had never been in it, actually. I'd lived in Santa Cruz County. I've lived there 16 years now, and I think it was only about 5 years ago I went to the slough for the first time paddleboarding. I feel like paddleboarding is one of those things that sort of boomed during the pandemic, and I certainly got a blow-up paddleboard. I feel like everybody got a blow-up paddleboard. And I just, the mixture of feeling this serenity of being out on the water, and I felt this way reading Crawdads too, this sense that there's both great peace and calm and sort of mastery of your world, but also such wildness and such danger in that wildness. I love sort of living on that edge. It's interesting that when I wrote the first draft of this, there was not a lot of nature writing in it because I live in nature and I was very nervous. I'm a big nature girl and I was nervous that it would overrun the book. And it was only because my editor kept saying, more of this, please, more of this, please, that it added up in this direction. You know, I think with any, I don't know if it's true for any first novel, but I was inspired by a lot of things in my own life, but I didn't want it to become didactic or boring or just about the things that I like. And it's actually one of the reasons that I focused so much in the beginning on working on Lana, because I feel like I'm so different from Lana, but I can admire and really love her. You know, one person said, I don't like Lana, but I love her, you know, and I think that's a great way to think about this character. And so the way that she looks at nature, all the things I think are so beautiful, she thinks are like disgusting. And writing that character helped me push against some of my own impulses in terms of just writing how I feel about these places.
Well, Jack
she has
knows.
That, yes.
Jack has always been there. So, and Jack has a very nurturing mother. So, you know, she's a little bit. I can't remember the name of the girl in Crawdads. Does anybody remember?
Kaya.
That's Kaya. It. Right. So Kaya's on her own.
Yeah.
Jack is a lot like Kaya, but Jack has a very nurturing mother who has come there and, you know, made a life for herself, which isn't all about the SLU because she works in a hospital up the road. But Lana is the one who finds herself in a totally foreign landscape because she is used to, you know, Wilshire Boulevard in downtown LA. And so the SLU for her is an enormous shock. And, you know, she's the one you have to wonder, is she going to have the skills or the will to cope with this place? Not the child, but the grandmother is the one who's going to have to make the biggest effort, you know, to live there.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, I was definitely inspired with Lana, too, by some of my friends who, women who, as they get older, feel that they are being invisibilized or taken less seriously. And I think that Lana is somebody who has built a world of power such that she has resisted that, but then that's taken all away from her when she suddenly is thrust into bed and in this little podunk rural town. And so a lot of the reason that Lana ends up investigating this murder, while of course, you know, she says it's to protect Jack, and definitely that's something she wants to do, she also is just looking for a way to be visible, to be seen, to be respected. And I think that that runs throughout the book. You know, there's a female detective in the book as well from the sheriff's office who is also trying to be seen in a different generation, a different race, in a different way. And the two of them have some negotiation about that. And again, you know, just this idea of what does it mean to be a strong woman? What does it mean to be a strong woman at different ages? And what's the difference between how the world sees you and what you're capable of? And how are you going to bridge that gap? Which in Lana's case involves a lot of forcing her way into situations. And Beth and Jack have a slightly different approach to it.
So how long did it take you and your mom to write this book?
I wrote this first draft in about 6 months. But I would say before that, we spent maybe 2 months just chatting about it because, you know, we didn't, in the beginning, we didn't need it to be a real thing. We just needed it to be a conversation topic that could take us somewhere else. And so I like to think of it like if you had somebody who was ill and you said, let's plan a safari. And you might never end up going to Africa, but you get out the maps and you're talking and that's engaging you. And so I actually felt quite embarrassed because I felt like we talked about these characters for a very long time before I wrote anything, and I thought that seemed kind of amateurish. But then, of course, what actually ended up happening was once I started writing these characters, I knew them so well because we'd been chatting about them and what would they be like, that it became very easy to write that kind of sharp dialogue that's in here and just to imagine how they would react to certain situations.
Right. So what previous writing experience did you have? You must have written, you know, if you're a museum director and so forth, obviously you wrote, but it would have been essentially nonfiction.
Right.
Had you written any fiction at all?
Never fiction, no. When I was a college student, I was an electrical engineering student by day and a slam poet by night. So I've always had this kind of left brain, right brain side to me. And I even feel with this book that, to me, the mystery and constructing that was a technical and intellectual exercise. How do you make a great puzzle? Where do you put the clues? All this kind of thing. How do you introduce suspects in ways that make them seem suspicious, but not too suspicious, but you don't forget about them? All of that felt like an intellectual puzzle that, to me, feels somewhat like engineering. Versus the women, writing these three women and this family, that was all heart, you know, and that was a very different kind of relationship I had with that aspect of this story. So yeah, never fiction, but when I was working in museums, I ran a blog for about 16 years that was one of the biggest blogs in the museum industry. And so I think through that, I just had this discipline of you write no matter what, and you put it out there, and it doesn't matter what's going on in your life. There are people, readers, who are expecting the next edition. You just keep doing it. You just keep doing it. So I certainly felt like I had confidence in my ability to produce something, and I'd written a couple of nonfiction kind of, you know, museum and cultural textbooks. So again, like feeling confident that I could create a full draft of a thing. But there were certainly some aspects, particularly dialogue, which I just never done before, and I was terrified of when I started writing the book. And then, of course, I started practicing. And as I got better and better at it, suddenly I wanted to do it all the time, you know? And so I think about it kind of like if you're learning to draw and you're trying to draw people and, you know, hands are often something that's very hard to draw. Yeah. And I worked with a lot of artists, right? And so often when you see people's early drawings, they're always like their hands are behind their back or in their pockets because they don't want to draw hands. But then once you learn how to draw hands, then you see these pictures where it's like hands all over the place. And so I felt that way about learning some of the basic skills of writing fiction as I was working on this book. And, you know, I was lucky enough after I wrote the draft, I worked with some great beta readers. I did some editing. And then when I signed with my agent, Stephanie and her colleagues, Molly and Adam, they gave me a huge education through three more drafts. Then we sold it to William Morrow, and Liz Stein, my editor there, gave me a huge education through three more drafts. So I feel like I got sort of a mini MFA from these incredible publishing professionals who were able to see something good in here and take me on a journey to make it stronger and stronger.
What was your mom doing while you were going on all these journeys with all these people?
I was texting her about everything. Actually, my mom was very, and both of us, I mean, this is sad, but we're in a great place now, so it's okay. We were very nervous. I was very nervous that she would die before the book came out. And as it's turned out, she's been on a great trajectory, and that has seemed further and further from likelihood with every month, which is just amazing. But I felt very urgently that I wanted this to come out so she could see it. And she felt urgent, but she felt more in a motherly and a protective of what I had done. Every time I told them that they wanted another draft, she was like, how many times can they make you write that? You know, she was very indignant about that. And I was like, no, it's getting better. It's getting better. And so I was, you know, she was always my first call about everything. And it was the exciting news, you know, as well as some of the bumps along the way. We planned a party. We did have this party right after Thanksgiving this past year, which it was a very kind of dangerous thing where if I did everything right, then right before Thanksgiving, the publisher was going to accept the final draft as locked, and then it would go for copy editing. So I planned this big party. I never had a big wedding or anything like that, so this is sort of the biggest thing I'd ever done. We had a caterer. My mom came up. And, of course, I'm planning this party, so you're inviting people to a party before it happens. And that was before my editor had said, yes, you are done. And so I just was so nervous. And my mom would say, are you sure you want to do this? Are you sure I should come up? Are you sure she's going to say yes? Because, you know, we'd been through this thing of every draft. Oh, okay, there's a little more. There's just a little more. And then you get like a 5-page letter with all the things that they wanted you to do. But fortunately, that time it was really done. We had a terrific party. And, you know, I hope that it will become an every book tradition now to have a big party and to celebrate with my mom.
Well, you really are hooked, aren't you?
I am. You know, this is my first novel, but like my fifth career. And I'm the kind of person who just goes all in on something with a lot of passion and love. And frankly, also, I want to be able to be there for my mom. And I don't want to take a job where I can't put it down to be with her, or where I can't do it from her bed if that's where I need to be. And this is, you know, this is such a gift to us that, and to me, you know, to be able to explore and learn and grow and challenge myself in this new creative and professional endeavor, and to be able to do something that allows me to be with her. So I'm not seeing a downside at this point.
No, I don't see.
And I get to come be here with y'all. So,
you do.
Yeah.
So is your mom prepared to write a second book?
Well, my mom has been saying maybe she needs to write a book. Well, and she, you know, it's funny because I've been working on some other books that don't involve these characters. And she has very generously offered to be an early reader on them, although we both acknowledge that she had some very idiosyncratic skill sets to be an early reader on this book that may not apply to every book necessarily. So.
No, I just wondered if she was inspired to either write with you or write something on her own.
I sure hope so. You know, I think that in a lot of ways, actually, this project came from the fact that she at times has mused about, oh, you know, maybe I should write a mystery. And but I think it's kind of like a maybe I should get a pony kind of thing. You know, it's like it's unlikely, but who knows? Maybe now it'll happen. I would love to be her first reader and support her if that's where she ends up going.
Well, I think we've said all we can say about the book. It's a wonderful book to read. If you like crawdads, I think you will also like this book, or you won't. What can I say? Anyway, how about questions? Anybody have questions for Nina?
Yes. Interesting.
Great cover, isn't
well,
it?
I'm curious to, you know, ask that back to you. So the answer is it's not me. It's the publisher. So thank William Morrow, although they did very generously involve me. It's one of these things where it's unclear to me as a debut author how much were they just letting me know and inviting me into the process, or how much did I have any sway? But fortunately, their initial concept was this concept with the binoculars. And I think that we did want something. I knew there were things I didn't want. You know, I didn't want a woman's face on the cover. I felt like there's a certain kind of thriller font that I just, you know, was sort of allergic to. And I think that, you know, Liz at William Morrow was very focused on, and this as a reader, I mean, I guess maybe you're more attentive to this than me. I'm so into the inside of the book, I don't think about it. But, you know, she was talking about all the different ways that the package of the book and the cover of the book help people determine, you know, is this for me or not? And right from where I'm sitting, I can see, you know, Lessons in Chemistry sitting next to Demon Copperhead, sitting next to Covenant of Water. You know, great books, very different covers, and they all give you a suggestion about who is this book for. So I had minimal involvement in some of the color choices, and I'm delighted by the cover. But one of the things, frankly, I'm delighted by is that I think it's pretty different from what I see, at least from a lot of mysteries and women's fiction books. And that to me, it feels like hopefully it won't get lost. Yeah. But I'm curious what spoke to you about it.
I loved the font.
Yeah.
I'll be honest. Yeah. I hate all the fancy fonts.
Yeah.
I thought binoculars were cute. And I love the color orange.
Yeah.
I just saw it and I was like, oh.
All right. Awesome.
So do you have a degree in electrical engineering?
I do.
So I'm an electrical engineer.
Nice.
I'm really impressed with your ability to be artistic. Because, as you know,
yeah,
being someone who's so analytical,
yeah,
to be artistic, and it's very impressive. And
yeah.
Kind of inspiring me.
Oh, good. All right. Well, you know what? I think that we all contain multitudes, and I think there is, especially in America, this drive around, like, especially in school, you know, you're going to find the career and you are going to do this for it. And success looks like continuing to do this thing. And I guess, you know, for me, I'm a person who I have a lot of different interests and I love to dive in. And I loved, and actually I've been thinking a lot recently about an electrical engineering professor I had who helped me understand why engineering wasn't for me. Cause he said, you know, at its best, engineering, it's like doing, playing games of chess all day long. And I heard that and I thought, oh, I don't want to do that. And, you know, my first job was at NASA and it was a dream job since I was a little girl. And there I am in this very small room doing math problems, you know, playing chess for a project that maybe would go on a payload in a few years. And I was just miserable. And I think that, but I've been thinking about what he said recently because I realized when I was working on some edits for this book, that there are a lot of ways that constructing a mystery to me is like playing chess. And it just made me realize, I think when Professor Emanuel was talking about that the dream is that you have a job that is like playing, making puzzles or playing games, you have to figure out what you slot in there, whether it's engineering or whether it's writing mysteries or whether it's doing something else. And then it's just a pleasure even when it's hard. So, yeah. Yeah.
Seems like you could use your analytical for the next novel that you write with your background.
I have got a lot of different, you know, I was the exhibit designer for the International Spy Museum for 5 years. And so I'd love to do some, I mean, one of the nice things about writing your first book after you've had multiple careers is there are a lot of different experiences to draw from. And I'm certainly having a lot of fun with that.
Is this a book that you, and I haven't read it yet.
Yeah.
I'm just getting
sure.
But that you could have a sequel or it could be, a series.
Yeah.
Type of thing.
You know, my understanding is that really depends on readers and on publishers these days in terms of whether that happens or not. We were talking at dinner about the fact that it used to be that all mysteries were about series, 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 and these days it's a lot about standalone. I'm personally of two minds of it. On the one hand, I love these characters. I love this place, obviously, and I do have dreams of other mysteries they could solve and adventures they could go on. On the other hand, you know, I wrote this book for such an idiosyncratic reason, and I feel like I'm just stepping into and diving into this world of writing fiction, and there are so many different stories and different kinds of characters I'd like to play with, and so I think that at least at this moment, you know, I've been really focused on this general thread of strong women in crime fiction. So I think there's always going to be some tough ladies and there's always going to be some dead bodies, but I don't really know if it'll be these tough ladies or if it'll be somebody else. But I'm a big athlete as well and super interested in an outdoors person. So just interested in different ways that women's strength manifests and how that can combine with crime fiction, which is just something I love to read so much. Yeah.
You have a lot of really wonderful blurbs.
Yeah.
Can you talk about that, especially for like a debut author?
Like, how do you get them? Yeah. So I look at this and I think about these individuals. So, you know, Rob Osler, who's at the bottom here, who actually did the event in San Francisco with last night. I met him a year and a half ago at a mystery writing conference called Left Coast Crime, which is a smaller version of this BoucherCon that we were just at. And I think that, you know, I got into this in a weird way, right? I wasn't writing for a long time and trying to get an agent. I hadn't written other books. So I didn't really have a writing community at the time that I got this book deal. But as soon as I started to go down the more professional publishing path, I decided, let me go to a couple of these conferences and let me see what I can learn. And what I found is, compared to my past life in museums in particular, people at these conferences are so nice and so generous and so willing to talk with you and to share their experience. And so, you know, I look at this and, you know, Rob and Kelly were people I met at this conference a year and a half ago. And when I first had these ARCs, this version that this woman has, these paperbacks, I contacted them and said, hey, you know, would you read it? Would you consider blurbing the book? And they were so generous to both say yes. And then Eli is somebody I've just admired forever. And I wrote him this fan letter and eventually met him, and I really connected with his wife. And so he wrote a great blurb. He loves the book. But as soon as he let go of that book, he handed it to his wife. She texts me constantly. She's like, I can't wait to get this for my friends. He texts me. He's like, I have this problem. My wife likes your book more than she likes my, you know, so his wife has really been a connector. And then a couple of these people, you know, Jesse is the big one for me, came through my editor. So when we were getting close with the publication, my editor said, you know, who are all the people who are your dream people? And then she had a list as well. And then I wrote love letters to folks. And, you know, Dial A for Aunties, I don't know, have you read it? Yeah. So some of you have. Yeah. So it is a hilarious, sort of a rom-com, sort of a mystery, sort of a family story. I would say the plot is not the point of it, but it just, I read it when my mom was sick and it made me laugh out loud. And I hadn't felt that way for a while. And I just, you know, through my editor, wrote this letter to her, and I can't believe she said yes. Now, I'll say there's about 20 people I wrote letters to who's, you know, who either never got back to us or got back to us late, or so, you know, it took a lot of requests out to get a small number of people saying yes. But the people who were the fastest to say yes were these people I'd met in person and who were just showing up for the writing community. It was clear in a lot of different ways. And we're ready to be part of it. And, you know, I've enjoyed, I mean, in my own small way, you know, as I've been meeting people, you know, I've been helping folks with, you know, oh, let's look at your query letter. Oh, yeah, you know, yeah, I'd be happy to introduce you to my agent, you know, and just, I feel like this is such a hard business. And so to the extent that people can be generous to each other, and certainly people have been generous to me, you know, it's like, why not? You know, and it's, if you're going to deal with rejection all day long as a writer, it's great to have, you know, people rooting for you and in your corner when occasionally you do get those yeses. Yeah.
There are a couple from the online audience here. Robin, who we know, you just signed a book for her. She says, Lana kind of reminds me a tiny bit of Janet Ivanovich's grandma. Is it Mazur? Mazur. Was she at all an influence?
That's so interesting because Janet Ivanovich certainly was, and just that combination of humor. There's a lot of physical comedy in those books, and certainly a lot of woman power. You know, I think of Grandma Mazur more related to Gigi Montero, who is a very bit character in this book, who's a patient of Beth's. Lana, you know, was most inspired more than anybody else. There is a memoir that my mom has a signed copy of. It is, if you get one of the original copies, the 80s power suit energy of this cover is just amazing. It's this book called They Can Kill You, But They Can't Eat You. It's by a woman named Dawn Steele, who has passed away, unfortunately, but she was the first woman to be to run a major studio in Hollywood. And before that, she had a wild career. She did all the merchandising for Hustler, and then she made toilet paper with the Gucci logo on it. I mean, she was just like this wild businesswoman and so outrageous and working in a very misogynistic world and just fighting her way through. And if there's anybody who I really look to for inspiration, it was Dawn Steele and her memoir about that time.
How about how did Jack get her name?
That's a great question. You know, Jack's name was always Jack. Beth's name changed, actually. Beth changed so much in personality that at some point I called my editor. I said, you know, we've made a lot of changes to this character. I have to have a new name. Not because the old name was bad, but it just wasn't, it was like, you know, giving somebody a lobotomy. It was a different person. Jack, I liked the idea of her having a boy's name. And I guess also, I thought about Beth was a teenager when she had Jack. And, you know, and I thought that this name Jacqueline was the kind of name that a teenager who was on her own might feel like it's a little bit fancy. It's a little bit like asserting I'm an adult and I can do this and I can have this child. But then, of course, because they live in nature and because they are, you know, outdoorsy, and Jack certainly is an adventurer, that it would be shortened to Jack made sense to me. Also say my daughter's name is Rocket, and I hadn't really... like a rocket ship. And I hadn't thought about the extent to which there's similar sounds in those names, but certainly I think of Jack as the kind of girl that I see my daughter growing up to be like. As she gets older, Rocket is a big outdoor adventurer. You know, she bikes to school by herself through the woods, and she is also very conscientious and responsible, which I see Jack as being as well. So I think that Jack is my aspirational child. And who knows what she'll actually be like when she's 15, but I'm sure she'll be great whatever the situation is. R-O-C-K-E-T. Yeah, you know, I was an electrical engineer. My husband was a physicist. We neither of us do those things anymore. But we wanted a name that was both sciencey and easy for many people in America to pronounce. And actually, if there was not a car company called Tesla, I think that we would have gone for that name. But I'm so glad we didn't for so many reasons. And Rocket's a great name. Yeah. Mo. I had a best friend who died of cancer about 12 years ago, just before Rocket was born. She was my climbing partner, and her name was Mo. And that's how Rocket got her middle name. Yeah.
You were running with your mom.
Yeah.
Did you come up with, like, the ending of the book?
Yeah. I would say that my mom and I spend most of our time and our brainstorming really around the characters and really around these women and what would this be like. And then also she did a lot of support around some of the research around the SLU. But as time went on, you know, the way some people talk about this idea of plotting versus pantsing, you know, are you writing from the seat of your pants or are you plotting out what you do? And my mom and I actually got a bunch of craft books about how to write murder mysteries that we both read. And so we talk about some of these things we were learning. But I was really writing it. And so one of the things that happens, of course, when you're writing a murder mystery is that a beta reader can only really give you good feedback about the mystery when they read the whole thing through once, right? Because to get a sense of which are the suspects, who do I mistrust at which points, which clue is an aha moment for me, where am I getting lost? If you read it multiple times, it's pretty hard to continue to hold in your mind, am I experiencing this as mysterious enough or suspenseful enough? So I would say my mom was much more involved sort of on the line-by-line level because she was reading everything as I wrote it. So I'd write a chapter, I'd clean it up a little bit, I'd send it to her. We didn't have a lot else going on during the day, so we'd usually talk about it that, you know, within the next couple of days. And then I'd take her feedback, and then I'd just keep writing. And sometimes I'd run into something where we'd have a bigger conversation about it. But a lot of times I feel like my mom was the kind of first reader who, on the one hand, most of her feedback and comments she gave were quite minimal. She loved to point out typos. She had a lot of opinions about what the characters were wearing. But the other thing she did that was so valuable is she always just asked me what's next and was always encouraging me to keep going. So I would not say that she was like deeply involved in the plotting or even in a place to really say, oh, this is suspenseful enough, or oh, I'm thinking too much about this character, because she was also so close to the text. It was more like she was, you know, my buddy and encourager in chief as I was writing that first draft.
That's an amazing experience that you and your mom had, that most people would never really be lucky enough to be able, despite the unfortunate and terrible reason that you came together. But, you know, as we grow up, we don't normally have that kind of intense relationship with our parents again as we did when we were young.
Absolutely.
So, you know, it was a real gift for you.
It really was. And I think also as a new writer, you always want feedback right away. And of course, it's not responsible. If you've asked a friend or somebody you trust, oh, could you read this? You know, could you read this whole manuscript? Or could you read these chapters? You can't text them the next day and say, what did you think? Like, that's not acceptable. But with my mom, I could do that all the time. So I feel like also for me, I could make unreasonable requests of her to read something for the eighth time. And she was always, you know, enthusiastic about it. And it, we were, you know, we spent a lot of hours. There's a lot of downtime when you're, you know, convalescing. And we spent a lot of that time talking about this book.
Well, I'm really glad that your mom has come along.
Me too.
And still here too.
I know now she's probably too busy for me. Now she's always going to Pilates and having lunch with her friends, which is great.
That's great.
Yeah, it is. Absolutely.
Cancer
it's great.
Is no longer an automatic death sentence. You know, it's still a word that terrifies us.
Yeah.
But it's really true that there are many forms of treatment now, and you know, you can live with it instead of die from it in a way that just wasn't possible before.
Yeah.
So thank you very much. And it was
absolutely
a joy to have you here.
Oh, it's
this
totally
our second
pleasure.
Full hour conversation, but I learned a lot of new things talking to you this evening. You can go back and watch the interview we did at the end of August, and much of it is the same, but a lot of it's really different. So I hope that you all go home and read the book and enjoy it. Hi there. Sorry, I've had my back to you this whole time. And recommend it to your friends because, you know, you can't ever have the experience of saying, you know, I was there when, unless you actually show up. So thank you very much for coming and, you know, for reading the book now and not, you know, after it becomes a bestseller and everybody's talking about it. You know, you can be an influencer is what you can be, right?
I have been told it is the longest of long shots for this to be a bestseller, but I also feel that the whole story of my mom's illness and this book coming to be is already a pretty long shot. So I think if anything's going to beat odds, hopefully we'll get there.
Yeah.
The sticker could help too.
Yay. Round of applause. Hello. We hope you're enjoying our programs and podcasts with authors. We'd like to expand them, and your help would be appreciated. Please make a donation at poisonedpenfoundation.org. 100% of the proceeds will go to help connect authors with readers in this difficult time. Thank you.